You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 1st, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Steeder, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Tony Caron, the editorial director for Al Jazeera America, is going to be talking with us about why the age of insurgency and turbulence has just begun in America, what this election looks like from the perspective of a foreign correspondent, and how Iran banked all of the benefits of having a nuclear program, having a nuclear weapon, without actually having one. How they have used negotiations to get a legitimate position for themselves in the international system. Touch on that. Also, it is caucus night heading into Iowa. Donald Trump back on top. Ted Cruz, not even his daughter likes him. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, neck and neck, slight edge for Hillary Clinton, but clearly massive enthusiasm for Sanders, massive rallies. See what happens. Police foiled a neo-Nazi attack on refugees that was planned in Stockholm. Really, really disturbing video footage. Really, really disturbing reality of what happened there. Thank God it was foiled. Attacks on Shias in Damascus by ISIL in an attempt to undermine tentative talks set for Geneva. And President Obama announced a massive new initiative on computer science education, coding. But basically, all anybody's thinking about is the election. It's finally here. People are about to finally actually vote for Donald Trump, caucus for him. It's really something else. How are you guys doing? How was your weekends? How were your weekends?
Mine was fantastic. I watched Mad Max Fury Road, and I thought it was just fantastic.
I liked that, and it was great. It's true. It's true. It was great. But I'm surprised that you haven't. I'm surprised you haven't seen it before, actually.
I don't watch movies in theaters terribly often.
I didn't see it in theater either. I actually thought stylistic. Like I forget. I watched that on pay-per-view with somebody once. But anyway, it was really good. What did you do, Miss Kelly? How was your weekend?
My weekend was good. I watched, if we're talking about movies, I watched Crimson Peak.
What is that?
It's a ghost story movie, a period piece. And it was good.
What, like, when did that come out?
It came out pretty recently. Like, I don't tend to go to movie theaters either, but so it probably just came on demand.
Okay, cool.
So
completely passed me by. I rewatched Dope this weekend, but I'd already seen it, and that is a very good movie. It held up. Let's talk about today's sponsor. Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a consigliere to a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people it hires. You see that each and every day in the Majority Report. And you can have whatever interpretation of that statement you want. I can also tell you that posting a job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short staff, there's no time to deal with dozens of different job sites. It's true. You don't, I mean, imagine setting up a dozen different accounts. The time is, it just accumulates and you're wasting time and you're already in an emergency position where you need someone immediately. You need someone new. There's no time to post on a dozen different sites until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post up to 100 on you can post to 100 plus job sites with a single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Just post once and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And Bill Clinton one time said, you always got to make the point three times. So a third time, go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. There's also a link to it on majority.fm. We will be right back with Tony Caron.
Boy, where you gonna run out at the Gideon star? When all the money that they rob from ghetto youths ain't enough to fly you to Mars. When the system you defend start break down like a Lego. When the whole world becomes a ghetto. That's when you realize the whole of we are ghetto people. Get the people. So tell me, suppose this slave don't forget the people. Get the people. Call them all. Remember, Haile Selassie never left the people. No time at all, not even an inch. Oh, no. Give me a phone, a demaka, a ital, no grabber. Make me call and start up on the rhythm proper. Every U-top shot apart the zigzagger. Make me show you what a clock a strike in a jam rocker. Politician, them a chatter tongue sharp like maca. Them not no vision, them a scammer, we a wave the banner. What kind of honor, uno na treat the youths with honor. Make me show no a vibes. Not true, you're living uptown. When the banks fall down, then the whole of we a get a youth. I mean, poor you rich, but when the poor shift, then the whole of we a get a youth. I mean, black you white, but when famine strike, then the whole of we a get a youth. On that day when you trade your Rolls Royce for a grain of a rice, that's when you realize that the whole of we a get a people. Get the people. So tell my about this slave, don't forget the people. Get the people. Get the people. Remember, Haile Selassie never left the people. People. Oh, no, no. Boy, warning to all the future leader them. Don't treat the youth like a different creature them. Seek a friend before you need a friend. Those children in the streets are with teacher them. Future soldiers and politicians. But I bet you cannot see it. Make me adjust your folly vision. Your eyes blurred by the guns and ammunition. So make me sure no a vibes. When the night turn day, white house turn gray, then the whole of we a get a youth. And me walk you drive, but when there's no oil, then the whole of we a get a youth. And when you can't tell Liga ni different from Tivoli, then you see say we a get a youth. When you can't tell Everdale from downtown.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Tony Caron. He is the editorial director for Al Jazeera America. Tony, how are you?
Good, thank you. Of the website of Al Jazeera America,
the,
that would be.
The website for Al Jazeera America, yeah. Pardon me. Tony, you have a couple of new pieces out that we're going to discuss on today's program, and I'm excited to talk to you from the perspective, in some respects, of a sort of foreign correspondent, someone who deals in global and international issues mostly, looking at the American election from that perspective to some degree. And you have a piece called In America, the Age of Insurgency and Turbulence Has Just Begun. And let's start really broad by explaining what do you mean by that?
Well, I think looking at events in the United States over the past couple of years, and I've been here for 20 years. So the starting point in the piece that you're referring to for me was just a year or two after I got here. Tim McVeigh detonated that bomb in Oklahoma City and killed 167 people.
Right.
And that signified, you know, here was an armed challenge to the U.S. government on U.S. soil. He was citing the case of the Branch Davidian siege in Waco,
right.
Texas,
mm-hmm.
Waco, and Randy Weaver and the Ruby Ridge shooting a year earlier. So this idea of American armed patriots, as he called himself, challenging the state was, you know, something that was like pretty shocking. But it didn't resonate, you know, that widely. It was almost like that terror attack happened in 94, and there was a real retreat, you know, by the right wing. And it sort of struck me, looking back at that time, that the Republican candidate for, you know, the nearest election following that event was Bob Dole. Bob Dole was so moderate by today's Republican standards. A lot of his policy positions would probably be the same as Hillary Clinton's. So you didn't really have that sentiment translate into, you know, some sort of mainstream politics. The militia movement sort of camped down after that.
We'll transition to today in just a moment, but that's a really important point. So let's tease that out a little bit more. You're talking about, this is the era where in 1994, a very, very radical Republican Congress sort of swept in to take over the House and the Senate, and pretty historic elections at that point. Democrats, Republicans had not run the House for decades, and they took back control of the Senate, running on the contract with America, which definitely did echo some of the kind of anti-government extremist rhetoric that you hear today. And there were people that were elected with some very conspiratorial thinking, and obviously Newt Gingrich is very much a man of the extreme right. In 1995, after the Oklahoma City terror attacks and this sort of outburst that arose from Waco and Ruby Ridge, which you have identified, what you're saying, and I think it is true, that there was a little bit of a sort of move back on the part of Republicans at that point, both through Bob Dole, who was, you know, conservative, but the establishment kind of choice candidate, more the equivalent of someone like Jeb Bush today, who's, you know, pretty irrelevant, frankly, in this process in many respects. And even on the more far right, there were people who, as you point out, they relaxed a little bit their stances on gun control. Now, you were going to move into the parallel today, so I'll just sort of let you get back to it, but I wanted to sort of further tease that out. But go ahead.
Well, right, and obviously, you know, George W. Bush is elected in 2000, and you know, that sort of anti-government insurgency goes a lot quieter, as it were. But it struck me that, you know, since President Obama was elected in 2008, and you had that very noticeable surge in gun sales and ammunition sales, to the point that there was an ammunition shortage in retail gun stores in America after the 2008 election. Same thing after the 2012 re-election of Obama. You know, fueled by fear. I'm sure the gun industry is quite happy to fuel the fear that the feds are coming to take your guns away. You better stock up. You know, and I think that is a great underreported element of the gun violence story in America, is that all of these guns that are being used in America in mass shooting after mass shooting after mass shooting are manufactured in America. They're contemporary weapons. Somebody is making a profit of, you know, arming Americans in this way. Nonetheless, you know, there's this very real phenomenon, which I've noticed, you know, over the last year alone, where, you know, most recently we've seen the nature reserve thing in Oregon, where, you know, a group of armed militiamen seizes government property, you know, brandishing weapons. They're protesting about, you know, federal land use, and you know, this becomes sort of, well, it ends up in an armed shootout. I mean, I did ask the question, you know, the killing of Lavoie Finicum, I think his name was, one of these guys. Does he become a martyr for, you know, a next generation of McVeighs? Possibly, but what's quite different, I think, today is that there's a far more of a mainstream resonance with the thinking that these guys represent in mainstream politics than there was in 1995. And there, I mean, I think, you know, there's the sort of armed dimension in you know, the idea that basically you'll have someone like Ted Cruz will very openly advocate that the Second Amendment means arming Americans against the federal government as a check against tyranny, as he puts it. And he also makes clear to his supporters time and time again that he sees the Obama administration as some kind of tyranny, as some kind of, you know, like he compares him to a monarch. So that kind of rhetoric.
I think you and I would both know more of a sultan, obviously, because of the Muslim thing. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yes. 60% of Republicans still believe Obama is Muslim. Right. But, I mean, yeah, so there's this feedback loop now between a mainstream politics and a mainstream you know, militia movement. And remember, the other thing that we can distinguish between 1995 and now is Fox News. There was no Fox News in 1995. Or you know, might have actually just been emerging onto the cable spectrum, but you didn't have, you know, you had Rush Limbaugh, you had a few notable, you know, right-wing talk radio type things, but this kind of real fracturing of the information spectrum that you've had in the digital age hadn't really taken full root yet, so that people, you know, live in parallel universes where Obama is, you know, he's both a Muslim and a communist, and he
that's true.
Is, no. Yeah. Although, yeah. Frankly, I mean, I, you know, just in parentheses there, I'd say a lot of us, it's very easy for a lot of us, you know, we can laugh at the insanity of the discourse on that kind of extreme right. You know, listen to Sarah Palin's speech, and yes, it's very hard not to laugh at this kind of incoherence. But I think what we maybe need to be much more aware of is the fact that ideologies don't need to make sense. They really don't. They need to resonate with the way people feel you know, motivate them to act. And, you know, the real question is, you know, people, I mean, it might be complete incoherent and contradictory nonsense, but if you know, if people are actually motivated to act on that basis, then you know, you're dealing with a very real phenomenon that needs to be understood.
I think that's exactly right. And I want to sort of index a couple of points here and get to the bigger sort of issues that I think you're raising, which makes your piece really important and distinct from just the kind of rehashing of, you know, yes, people are crazy, you know, in parts of the political spectrum. That's quite clear. But I think what's fascinating is that from a policy perspective overall, and again, if we're taking the track, you know, sort of tabling people like Bob Dole, but if you take the sort of contract with America Republicans through, in fact, even George W. Bush, which ran and was branded in the first election as a sort of reinvented conservatism, compassionate conservatism, kind of like a Republican third way kind of thing, but governed very far to the right, and then, of course, you know, engaged in a very hawkish foreign policy. Moving up on and through today, with maybe the exception of Donald Trump, just because Donald Trump has been so unspecific on most of his policy proposals, but the actual policy agenda of, you know, Newt Gingrich in 1994 through Marco Rubio is not really radically different. It's deregulate, and throw money to top end earners. That's pretty much it. And then there's some variance on issues like immigration, but there certainly has always been a very big nativist strain in the Republican Party. So in some respects, it underscores, at least from my perspective, what you're saying, because I don't think that these are like, these aren't policy conversations. They're attitudinal and emotional. And that sort of sense of deep alienation, which was certainly there in the 90s, disappeared to a large degree under Bush. And obviously that sort of shows, you know, the racial and other dimensions to what's going on. But they've reemerged in a way that is so powerful and so widespread among certain voters and demographics that it is aped and parroted and reinforced by quote-unquote mainstream Republicans. And even including, you know, at certain times, guys like Chris Christie, I mean, you know, have said very extreme things about Obama and you know, the, right. Sort of in all of this. So it's sort of very deeply and broadly felt. And
Very nationalist. Yeah. And very nationalist,
that's right.
Well.
That's right. Very nationalist and very racially coded. And you point to, and I think this is where, you know, we can also maybe potentially get into points of comparison to places like Europe or Latin America, and maybe they're bad points of comparison. But it does seem that the track that runs through all of this is, you know, anger can go in irrational and hostile and bigoted directions, but it can come from a legitimate place. And a legitimate place is growing inequality, is a hollowed out middle class, is deindustrialization. You point that out, that there are real things happening here that usually are a harbinger of this type of reactionary politics.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, definitely the economic crisis of 2008, for example, really plunges a lot of middle class people into poverty, essentially, into and that a lot of these things are symptoms in quite a classical sense of that kind of economic stress. That the, I mean, throughout, from Reagan onwards, throughout the even throughout the Clinton era, when the economy was growing, inequality was widening, and the real incomes of working Americans was basically stagnant or falling. So, you know, that for all of the good years that people sort of, you know, cling to as an idea, whether they're Reaganites or Clintonites, people, you know, middle, white, you know, working class people, not only, you know, I was going to say white, but not only, you know, people with union jobs, people with industrial jobs were actually, their living conditions were actually declining. So I think, you know, these kind of political swings are, you know, symptomatic of that in many countries. I do think we need to be a little careful with drawing simple comparisons to, you know, Europe, for example, where you can see, yes, there's a rise of far right, you know, nativist parties and anti-immigrant sentiment and so on. And there's a rise of, you know, on the left of kind of anti-austerity parties that are challenging the kind of technocratic mainstream of sort of the European sort of center left over the past 30 years or so. It's easy to kind of go, well, that's Bernie Sanders on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other hand. But I think, you know, Europe has a very different history of class politics, overt class politics, that, you know, which was not really ever, you know, part of political discourse here. And therefore a different social contract, and almost, you know, I guess in both cases, the idea of the social contract is up for question. You know, the idea of the nation and who comprises it is in a really interesting way, but also in, you know, quite a scary way perhaps. You know, that racializing of the discourse in America, for example, you really get the sense that you know, if all nations, as the social scientist Benedict Anderson, who died recently, so eloquently put it, all nations are imagined communities. The sense of, you know, there's an imagined history, the mythologized history, a common, you know, that creates this kind of common sense of who we are, what we are, what we believe, what differentiates us from others, and so on. And I think in America today, it's far more. It's basically been torn up to some extent, or it's been fractured. I think, you know, people in different political camps and political blocks are increasingly having very different ideas of what it is that binds them, that what they mean by being American. You know, they have different coded subtitling, as it were, for that. So I think,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
No,
I was going to say, the other thing that the other interesting differentiator, I think, in terms of class politics for me, is the class politics on the Republican side have actually changed really in a very interesting way just in the last decade or so, where, you know, traditionally one could look at the Republican Party as a party of big, you know, corporate interests, big business, that has kind of mobilized working class people to vote for it in many instances, right, on the basis of specific appeals, whether that's on the question of race or questions of religion, social conservatism, etc. But there's always quite a coherent sense that the job of, you know, the political administration is to aggregate the interests of, you know, the greater good. Now, when they say the greater good, they may mean the interests of an economic elite, but nonetheless, the aggregated interests of that elite. Mm-hmm. And I think what you've seen more and more recently is this idea of sort of one billionaire, one candidate.
Right.
That there's a real indiscipline. There's a real, what, you know, the Republicans were famously able to settle on a candidate, you know, with George W. Bush, a classic example. 2 years before that election, they'd settled on him as the candidate. He looked, you know, the guy most likely to, you know, and see to beat Gore. He had attracted black and Latino votes in Texas. He's the guy. They all settle on it. All the money goes to him. Now you've got absolute anarchy in the Republican Party among that class of kind of very, you know, corporate wealthy donors. And, you know, that's playing out in a way that that element is no longer able to coherently control the party to the extent that it once was, I think.
I think that's not only is that true, and I also think the other thing that has actually been positive about Donald Trump, and there have been some unintentional positive things about him, is that he has sort of, and we've talked about this before, he in some respects has sort of like exposed the veneer as well of some notion that sort of if you're a plutocrat or you're wealthy or successful in business, then that more sort of automatically translates to you have a certain wisdom or intelligence or leadership qualities that translate out of that. I mean, you can just be a crazy guy who has a lot of money and is loaded. And I think whether it's him sort of overtly showing that as a candidate himself, and even these sort of individual billionaires looking for their one candidate, and, you know, and there's big variety, you know, there's big variance there. I mean, Sheldon Adelson is just, you know, I need my casino to never be investigated, and Israel needs to be able to do whatever it wants, whenever it wants, and those are my issues. And then, you know, the Koch brothers are, you know, protect their various industries, and that's entwined with a deep fanatical ideology. And then, you know, there's a guy, I forget his name, but a guy who's, you know, backing Rubio, who basically just doesn't like Jeb Bush. I mean, you know, he's a Republican, but it's like, there's an opportunity to screw over Jeb Bush. I mean, and so it's sort of like, you know, even within that, you're revealing that, okay, you have a couple billion dollars and you're, you know, you're a child like anybody else. And there's something actually healthy about that being shown in the body politic. Now, the last question I want to ask about this, and it just occurred to me while you were talking about the sort of disintegration in some respects of national identity. And I know you just, you know, shied away from shaky comparisons between the United States and Europe, and you can shut this down as well because this is even further afield. But it did sort of provoke my curiosity when you mentioned it. What is there anything now when you see that sort of re-racialization and collapse of a certain type of national identity that reminds you at all, even, you know, not directly, but indirectly, of your experience in South Africa?
Interesting. Yes, I should tell your listeners, if they hadn't noticed the accent, that I'm from South Africa. I grew up there and was active in the anti-apartheid struggle for a decade. And, you know, I think what's common, what reminds me of South Africa were the sort of scenarios we were seeing last year and Ferguson and Charleston and Baltimore, etc. That, you know, the sense that I think that, you know, for people living, you know, people living in black communities, there's a sense, you know, often that they're being ruled by an authority that doesn't represent them.
Right.
It's also interesting that, you know, what actually I had actually noticed, like literally sometimes in those communities during TV coverage, you see kids on the street turning around to the camera, you know, and saying, this is just like Gaza, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
That idea of almost like an occupied people,
right.
That there's a real disconnect. And it's interesting that basically, you know, we've seen, and perhaps it's only because of the existence of the technology to capture it, the cell phone video and so on. But during a black presidency, we've seen this kind of what feels like an absolute surge in racialized police violence.
Yeah.
And you know, almost to a degree that you wouldn't have, you know, seen in South Africa in some instances where, you know, it was more in the context of protest. Well, no, actually, that's not true. So, yes, I mean, definitely echoes and definitely.
And maybe also the white fear, that white terror, like that by the time, you know, you were, I mean, I just even reading about it and studying it, it was fascinating to me. Of course, like there was the propaganda about the ANC and Mandela and you know, and Cathedra and Mbeki and all these leaders, and obviously it was guerrilla war and it was oppression, but amongst white South African citizens, there was this very legitimate, at least in their minds, Mandela's going to take over and we're going to get killed. And that kind of parallels, you have this totally conciliatory, moderate black president, and it's like, but he's a secret Muslim and he really hates us and we really are under siege.
And if you look at the sort of propaganda, if you look at NRA propaganda leaflets, advertising campaigns, so on, this very racially coded idea that you need to arm yourself because there's a mob of people who are going to come to take away what's yours. And that those people are typically portrayed in that kind of, propaganda in the material as being other than white. I think that is definitely, and also I think that basically, on a more fundamental level, the kind of things that Ta-Nehisi Coates actually points out in his writings, that America's never really reckoned with the racial violence on which it was founded. It's almost like, there was slavery, then there was Dr. Martin Luther King, we now have a national holiday, it's all good, let's move on.
Right.
Let's move on. Why are you talking about the past? And it's like, actually, that there's never really been a reckoning with that past. There's never really been... it's a symptomatic of the sort of national idea that it kind of, it's too disruptive to to the assumption of virtue on the part of the founding fathers must have been all good, as opposed to the real sort of ambivalence of that legacy. So I think that's interesting, and obviously that's something that happens in all nations and to all national stories. The French, maybe France actually has a more even more complicated idea of it, because they can't really, they don't want to reckon with Algeria. They don't want to reckon with the violence, that goes into their relationship with their formerly colonized people. So it's not uncommon.
Right. Not wanting to deal with history is uncommon. I'm just reminded, and then we'll briefly get to Iran, but I remember taking a pre-law class at, undergrad several years ago, and I was at, a pretty elite liberal arts school. It was tough to get into and everything, and with smart people. And it was a constitutional theory class, and the professor said at one point, and this is in a very, this was not in the middle of any type of political polemic. It was just an objective comment that the Constitution is an objectively pro-slavery document in its original iteration, because, that was the political compromise that allowed it to go forward. This is very obvious. And, there were people in the classroom that were, deeply offended, almost as if you were sort of, insulting a religious text and not just sort of speaking in this, just very historically objective way. And it was fascinating to even see that sort of show up in that in that context, in this sort of, laid back seminar room. So let's move briefly. You have this other or another recent piece called How Iran Set Its Own Place at the World's Top Table. And essentially saying, and I think, the sort of benefits of the deal between Iran and the P5 plus one are to me, pretty apparent. And they're sort of, potentially even ancillary benefits, maybe in a place like Syria down the road. But you sort of demonstrated the interesting paradox of this, which is that by kind of having a strategy of ambiguity on Iran's part, and by sort of getting to this place of negotiation, they essentially banked the benefits of having a nuclear deterrent without actually having one. Can you explain that?
Right. Yes, absolutely. I think that, if you take a historian's perspective, you step back and you lose all the kind of political, rhetoric of, around this thing. Why did Iran ever have a nuclear weapons program, or at least why was it doing nuclear weapons research? Why was it putting in place the possibility of building nuclear weapons? If you look at the CIA, the national intelligence estimates on Iran. They make it very clear, and it's blindingly obvious to anyone who studies statecraft. Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapon, or isn't, you know, considering building one, right, because it wants to destroy Israel, because it's not a suicidal country. It's a status quo power. It's about keeping itself in power.
Machiavellians and robes, yeah.
Yeah, and so basically their starting assumption is that basically Saddam Hussein, which we all know he was doing, is building nuclear weapons, therefore we may need a nuclear deterrent because he is our primary
in the
1980s.
In the 1980s,
enemy.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, right. And nearly a million people die in the war between Iraq and Iran. So, you know, basically Iran's goal from the beginning with all the nuclear work that it was doing was regime survival, and basically security guarantees and engagement in the world economy, membership of the World Trade Organization, etc. And basically what Iran realizes is that there are two things to say about the non-proliferation treaty to which Iran is a signatory. One is there's a basic hypocrisy in that the big powers, you know, the original nuclear five, which is the US, Russia, China, France, and Britain, basically sign onto the NPT on the basically their commitment in the NPT is that other nations will not develop nuclear weapons in order that the big powers can disarm and we can do away with nuclear weapons entirely. Clearly that element, I think it's Article 6 of the NPT, there's nothing doing on that front. The big powers are all as committed as ever to their nuclear deterrent. I mean, basically Britain is still stuck on Trident, never mind the United States, you know, right. Obama spending $3 trillion to upgrade the fleet, Russia building new generations of delivery systems, etc.
Even as Obama has reintroduced the notion of a nuclear-free world in his foreign policy, he's still spending, as you say, $3 trillion to upgrade the infrastructure of our arsenal. I just wanted to underline
exactly.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, what that's meant is that there's a certain unwritten law of geopolitics in the post-World War II era that to get a ticket to the big table, to get rights that no other state really has, the right to behave beyond the reproach of sort of international community and consensus, nuclear weapon is the best way to go. So India, Pakistan, apartheid South Africa, and Israel, and then later North Korea, all basically developed nuclear weapons for the reasons of their need to be able to act outside of, you know, that kind of international consensus and to be accepted on their own terms.
Right.
Basically, Iran is pursuing the same thing. Iran, quite cleverly, I think, actually sees that there's an ambivalence in the NPT, which allows states to remain, you know, on side, remain within the terms of the NPT, but to assemble all of the infrastructure that it would be needed to build a nuclear weapon very quickly. It's called the nuclear latency or the threshold capacity. Mm-hmm. Japan is always cited as a classic example. It's believed to be the proverbial screwdriver's turn away from having a nuclear weapon. If it chooses to, it could probably build one in 3 to 6 months. Right. Because of infrastructure it's assembled while staying in good graces, you know, with the NPT. So Iran takes that option and demonstrates to the world, essentially, they can build nuclear weapons. And, you know, while we always hear, and it's correct, that, you know, sanctions and that sort of pressure brought Iran to the table, what's never really asked is what brought the Western powers to the table with Iran, with a state that they dismissed for years as a rogue state sponsor of terrorism, etc. Why suddenly, 2 years ago, is John Kerry, you know, sitting, negotiating on very equal and respectful footing with Iran's foreign minister? It's basically because Iran has demonstrated the capacity to build nuclear weapons, and therefore that the kind of security threat and risk of allowing this confrontation to escalate becomes too much, and it becomes preferable for the world powers to actually engage with Iran more on its own terms than they would have liked to.
Right. So then it's sort of the whole conversation gets flipped, because we run away from this delusional conversation that Iran is, you know, is secretly building this so that, you know, at the date of some Shia prophecy, they can launch a nuke at Israel and all of this nonsense, which, you know, actually passed for serious analysis in some circles of D.C. And then you actually flip it.
Although not in Israel. Not in Israel.
Right. No, Israel had a much more sophisticated.
Yeah, the Israeli security establishment never bought the kind of apocalyptic stuff that Netanyahu was actually telling, telling the U.S. Congress and so on.
Right, and that was actually sort of the two things that I wanted to get to briefly before we wrap this up are exactly on that track, because it seemed that on one hand, I knew a few people who made a slightly more sophisticated argument, which was that with regards, of course, the apocalyptic gonna try to destroy Israel and commit suicide thing is delusional. But as in the examples that you cited of apartheid South Africa, Israel, Pakistan, India, and, you know, frankly, the United States, or, you know, any power who has that capacity can get away with more. That Iran's behavior in other parts of the region, whether it's, you know, propping Assad or backing Hezbollah, it becomes harder to confront them in its sort of asymmetrical activities under this agreement and with that capacity. And that's the sort of, you know, deeper critique. I don't see how that takes away personally from, you know, I don't think that in some respects is neither here nor there with the agreement. But that seems to raise a more interesting question about what this capacity means for Iran.
Well, the thing is, I think actually if there hadn't been a deal, that argument would be stronger.
Right.
In other words, if Iran had built and deployed nuclear weapons and tested them, and therefore had a nuclear deterrent, which it doesn't currently have,
right,
then it would be beyond reproach and therefore able to be more adventurous in its foreign policy. So
right.
I think what Iran has done has traded the capacity to build nuclear weapons for, you know, security, diplomatic, and economic gains.
Right.
And so right now, the status quo right now doesn't allow Iran to build and deploy a nuclear weapon in any kind of short order. It's not like the deal doesn't codify Iran having threshold capacity, except, you know, in a hypothetical sense. It would have to break out of the deal for, you know, a year or more in order to actually go there. So, you know, I would say, if anything, that argument actually works on the side of why the deal, you know, keeps... why the deal is a net gain for those concerned with that kind of security perspective.
Right. And Tony, if we could speak Trump for a second, I think we'd actually have to say it was a great deal and it was fantastic. It was great. Tony Caron, I really appreciate your time. Tony Caron of Al Jazeera America. We have links to both of your pieces on majority.fm. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Bye. Be well. Okay, folks. We are going to get to the fun half. We will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We have a ton of sound. Donald Trump was making the rounds and, obviously it was pretty funny. Bernie Sanders, we have some good sound of him sort of closing the argument in Iowa and a bunch of other stuff. Want to get to this bombing in Damascus, which is definitely correlated with sort of disrupting this next round of negotiations that might be taking place in Geneva. And... I think I have some stuff to get off of my chest about this whole Bernie bro thing, which is really starting to irritate me. So we will get to that in the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Go to majority.fm/become a member. It's less than a cup of coffee, and you'll feel great about it. It's really, really something that, I mean, we say it every day. It's what allows this show to exist. It's as simple as that. Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Even if you're a member, it helps us climb up the iTunes rankings. Majority Report. I think I have like a dyslexic block with this. It's majority.fm/kickback, or is it majority?
That's correct. Nope, that's it.
Majority.fm/kickback. And you can go do your shopping at jet.com, which is a new socially responsible alternative to Amazon. Which is a really good service, really good company. Or you can go to Amazon and use our link as well. Either way, it helps us out a bit. And I believe on Jet, it's 15% off of your first purchase if you use our link. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Tea, Coffee, and Chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. All are great ways of helping the show. Like us on Facebook follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. I think we're Sam Cedar we're The Majority Report on Facebook, excuse me. We will see you in the fun half. IMs will be on in a second.